My name is Yasuyuki Matsunaga. I've been asked to chair this concluding session, and my understanding is that now all of us can start quizzing the organizers, and that means that we can challenge the organizers with the tough questions and ask them why how successful this has been according to the organized point of view. And also, we'd like to invite all of you to ask questions to all the panelists on the panel, and start asking fundamental and deep questions. So we may be able to come up to some kind of some sort of concluding views or consensus, if possible. First, yesterday we had the first session, and the one of the diverging views are, and also this morning as well, there's one emerging consensus was that there is a dominant paradigm, which some of us called the control paradigm, and some of the panelists proposed alternative paradigms to that control paradigm. One panelist called it a sustainable security paradigm, and the others called attention to the other aspect of the that the dominant paradigm is lacking, for example, the ecosystem or sustainability in a different, more global and systemic paradigm. So first, I would like to ask some of us, first of all, Professor Hirose, and then Professor Sakai, and also, I'm not sure we have everybody, but first, let me ask two professors about their assessment of the how successful this symposium has been, and also I would like to ask them to ask questions for everybody so we can start a discussion for in search of a concluding consensus. Professor Hirose, please.
Thank you very much. Yesterday, during session one, we looked at the new types of conflicts. Session one, we looked at the emerging new conflicts. And Professor Christopher Cushing spoke about the four global trends in the way of dealing with the conflict and the threats. Professor Tosa spoke about the so-called new wars. The traditional conventional wars might have been epistemological, and he suggested that taking diverse viewpoints, and he referred to classical paintings in order to depict the war. He spoke about the cognitive turn. Professor Norman Cook spoke about human security in the context of development, effective approach towards governance and poverty is changing in substance. ODA-based programs are changing in nature. There is a lack of integrative approach. Professor Wadir Safi discussed that looking at the Cold War and during the post-Cold War, what the new wars are bringing us as a challenge in Afghanistan. As a member of the organizer of this session, I was a member in devising this program. All the messages were very insightful. I am very happy as the organizer. I would like to thank all the speakers. But of course, all the speakers have different backgrounds, which was referred to yesterday, for example. Some members are from the conflicting nations, and some members are from the so-called Western society, where there is no conflict. And the standpoint and perspectives might be different. That is true, and that is an interesting aspect to discuss. So how can we share the common perspective in order to think about the new war and new conflict? How can we share a common foundation? How should we start thinking about an effective common approach? How should we establish new concepts? And that would be the direction that I would like to move forward. As for future perspectives, can we be optimistic or should we be more pessimistic? Do we have to start our discussions by accepting the darkness of the situation, or should we look more at the bright side? That would be another perspective. Thank you. Thank you very much. I was in charge of session two. We had a sparring in the morning, and you still remember that, which means that I do not need to summarize about the morning discussion. As Professor Matsunaga requested, has the discussion been in line with the aim and the goal? Has this been successful? I would like to focus on that aspect. Now, the discussion of the gap between practitioner and academia. Of course, we wanted to see a clash, so to say. I don't know if Professor Isazaki had the same interest, but I honestly wanted to see a clash of academia and practitioner. That was intentional. We wanted to bring the two camps together, and we tried, and certainly there was a clash. But still, it is a frustrating fight, so we might see a continuing of a sparring during this general discussion. But in session two, at the very end, and during session three, in ways that we saw and heard, on the one hand, what is discussed in the academia might not exactly be useful in the field, or what is discussed in the academia might not be reaching the field and might not be utilized. That happens very often. If I may talk about something personal, I am an expert of regional studies, and that area is the Middle East. Within the academia, I am in the marginal area of academism. Within the international political science, I am not in the most advanced area. I am not in the most theoretical political science area. I admit that what I am doing is in the most marginal area. I just started from knowing about a certain region, which is the Middle East. And now, these days, I am teaching my student that theory is important. You know this month, are you listening to me? I am emphasizing how important theory is. You recall my studies and lessons. But as I mentioned earlier, when I study the regions and areas, I look at that fact, I find that truth, and why can't we communicate this truth and that real truth? But when you fail to communicate, you have to think about making the communication more easy to understand. But by generalizing a certain truth, by creating a framework and a concept, you might be able to promote better understanding. So that is why I say that theory is also important, because it is important to conceptualize, and conceptualization does sometimes promote better understanding. That is my way of thinking behind this project, and maybe I have not explained myself fully to our students, and maybe there isn't even a consensus amongst the staffs ourselves, but we have at least started out this project. So how can practitioners contribute to conflict resolution and peace building? And how can the academia deal with the needs of the practitioners? Those are the questions that we are forced to re-ask ourselves. And we were certainly forced to think. So in that sense, it was meaningful. But then about the answer, that is still an outstanding challenge. So I hope, my students, you continue to study hard and work hard, because there are so many outstanding questions.
At six professors from the session one and session two, those who have the questions, written questions in front of you, please go ahead and answer the question. If not, please give us your overall impression, assessment about this symposium, and please give us the advice about how the PCS should go ahead from us, from this conference, and how we can improve our education in peace and conflict studies, and what kind of practical suggestion or academic approach that we should be looking into. Can we invite Professor Cushing?
Thank you. As I don't have any questions in front of me, I'll just assume that my presentation was so successful that all the questions were answered, all the points were understood, and that I can go home to England and with a happy smile on my face. It's been a very busy day and a half. It's a bit like a tsunami, I find. And there's so much information, so much analysis and interesting points which are briefly mentioned, and then we move on to the next one, that it really does feel like a 100-foot wave just breaking over our heads, I think. On this question, this last question, which has dominated a lot of today, about the academic practitioner divide, it's interesting that for people concerned with peace, that the approach or the way we've looked at this has been as a conflict. And in my experience, I've always thought that it's been very beneficial to have worked in the field with NGOs, to work in government on policy and NGOs and policy, to work in the UN and private sector at the sort of headquarters and field level, at the policy and program level, because I think that to be successful or to be as good as we can be in any of these different areas of work, and we're all trying to work towards the same goal, that it's very important to understand the perspectives of the other actors or the other stakeholders in that type of work. And what I've found, that, and I've been lucky in my career, is that I've been able to have that experience in different sectors and different areas. Because once you're inside the government, you can understand what the foreign ministry needs and the interests they have and the priorities they have. When you're working with an NGO in the field, you understand what the day-to-day reality of a conflict or a crisis is like. And once you understand that, then when you're having a conversation with those other actors in whatever position you are, you can understand that, and it's a much clearer communication, which is, I think, what the point of the third session today was about. I would believe that it isn't so much practitioner or academic, but it's really that all of these levels have to be understood and have to reinforce each other. Because if you're working in the field on programs and operations, your world is going to be defined by the policymakers at a regional or headquarters level. And for to be really understanding what's happening, you have to understand the deep analysis of academia. I've been in the field as a regional director during a war and running operations in 9 countries for 6 months, and I've had an academic team in London sending me every week 100 pages by fax, which was all this deep analysis of the conflict in Zaire, in this case. And it was very useful because my office was in the back of a garage in Kigali in Rwanda, and it was very hot. And so I was able to use all of this paper to keep the window open to get a breeze through the office. That's because even though the academics had a very good intention to try to help and to inform us on the day-to-day operations, It was so abstract and so disconnected to what we were dealing with on a day-to-day basis in 9 countries for 6 months of a war that it was completely useless. So the intention was good, but the practical implementation was mistaken. When you're in the field on a day-to-day basis, what happens at headquarters, what happens at the policy level, what happens academically is irrelevant. You're just trying to keep up with the chaos of the day-to-day. But to be better at your job at any of these levels, you have to understand as much as you can from the other levels. So if you're working in the field, it's helpful to know the policy framework you're operating in. It's helpful to know the historical or the political analysis of the conflict. It really does help to understand that as much as possible. If you're working at the policy level, either for NGOs or government or UN, you have to understand the reality of the field, because most policy that's made is complete crap. I don't know how that translates into Japanese, but it's got nothing to do with the reality on the ground. It's the imaginations and the dreams of bureaucrats sitting in air-conditioned offices 1,000 miles away who think they understand what the conflict is about and have defined in their own minds what the solution is going to be. And then part of that is the academic framework on top of all of that, trying to provide, you know, reflection. The most important contribution I think academics can make is to really have that long-term thinking and understanding and that deep analysis, that reflection on what is this all about, particularly on learning the lessons from other conflicts and applying the correct lessons to current or future conflicts. Now, a lot of that may have to take place in training or in education. As we've been meeting the students at Tufts, a number of them have field experience and are quite experienced in different things, and now they're taking some time out to sort of get that academic background and depth to what they have known and what they have seen. So in my approach, if I was reflecting back to my presentation, it's root causes and the immediate day-to-day crisis that you have to have in balance. And that's what I think we see with academic policy and practitioner debates, is that you need to be competent to do your best, whatever that is, on a day-to-day basis, on the hard reality on the ground. But you have to balance that with a higher understanding and analysis, where you take a step back and see the bigger picture. When you're working in the field, it's so easy to be caught up in the small day-to-day things that keep you alive or reduce the suffering for the populations that are affected by a conflict that you're there to serve. And it's very difficult to take a step back and see that bigger picture. And so that's why I would suggest that for people in our work to have those different experiences, to be an amphibian. You know, you work in the water, you can work on the dry land, you can cross these barriers that we create between practitioners and policymakers and academics. I think that kind of experience is very good. The only problem, of course, is that it takes 50 years of all that experience before you actually know what you're doing enough to be maybe sent into the field or to make decisions or to set policy. But that's the beauty of life. So I hope that is okay.
Thank you very much. Professor Tosa, please.
I have received one question. But that is a question about the name of a publication. But I have that paper with me, so I'll have to give it to you later. And the comment about the general on session 2 and session 3, there are some comments I'd like to make. Well, Professor Sugiono is not here anymore, but there are 3 approaches in his paper. And I am specialized on political science, and social constructivism is what I wanted to refer to. Well, briefly speaking, this is exclusive identity. How is that formed in your daily lives? Current sociology or political science, that may be a well-known concept, but related to that, this kind of exclusive identity, the process of forming that kind of identity, is available everywhere in our daily lives. And I wanted to make a criticism on that, that Professor Isazaki said that sounds political, but our daily life are all entirely related to politics. The relationship with friends or with enemy is available everywhere. And what I mentioned yesterday is that an absolute relationship with an enemy, how can you stop that relationship from increasing? And the background might be economic reasons, and many other reasons might be related to that. But the third point related to that is that exclusive identity formation, to stop the process of that formation, to do that, communication is important. And related to that, I think it's better to give a specific example. There was a case of Rwanda I mentioned earlier, ICTR, International Criminal Tribune. International Criminal Tribunal Court for Rwanda. That is a media case. That's a case of hate speech. People who made a hate speech were charged of many charges, including crime against humanity. So that was a very well-known case in international law. And what's important in this process is that people who try to make a absolute relationship, absolute enmity, I think that kind of people. But one example would be the case of Channel 2 that we have in Japan. There are many hate speeches on that internet page. And a silent majority who are not interested in that will not participate in that anymore. And that is a silent majority. And that discourse on Channel 2 is a world dominated by hate speeches. And if that happens in real society, what happens? There are people who promote hate speech, and that will lead to cases like the case of Rwanda. So in hate speech, we call it the spiral of silence. People who think about peace, oriented towards peace, would become something that are not there anymore. And only people who want to promote enemies would be dominant. And how to stop that relationship, that was based on the discussions that we had on session three. That was my understanding about the discussions that took place on session three. And the next subject, I don't think that is on the matter of practitioners, but people like us, writers of publications, is also important. The question is how to represent silent majority, how to make them express. To represent means to express yourself and represent someone. There are two meanings. So to represent and express the silent majority, not only through advertisements, but through written media. In our case, not only academic publications is important, but opinion magazines. We also write sometimes articles on such magazines. And well, currently we are saying that TV is more important, but to represent silent majority, the work of trying to represent silent majority might be a work of building peace against those who want to promote enemies. And so that was the main point I wanted to convey today. Thank you.
Taffy, for the comment, please.
Thank you very much for giving us the last chance. I will start like saying we are here in anywhere in order to learn more. What was excellent for me in this trip to Japan, especially in this symposium I got, I learn more and I want to learn more. And those who are thinking that they will rule the world only by weapons and by high technology in weapons, in this I don't believe. And I would expect that if we had an expression or a terminology in the philosophy or even politics, which was called utopian socialism, let's not make the peace practically utopian. It means there must not be much differences remained in this global village between human beings. If we are talking about globalization and we impose the will of those who are very developed in every aspect, I think we have gone to the wrong way. Economy, strong economy, of course, is the base. But if you want to impose your political will, it will not be solving the questions. As I was not expecting from our very strong practitioners to say what they say today, I want a compromise between practitioners and academic. From where the practitioners can learn to put into practice what they want to go to reach to the peace. If there are no academicians, they would not even say these words today. Of course, we must learn from our practitioners, and practitioners must also look to those who are putting for them only in the book. Of course, it will be also a product of the life, of scientific life of some people and those who has worked on and will work on, and until they are alive, they will study and work on more and more. So in this world, which is very advanced in some part and very, very backward in some other part, as I had expressed in my essay-like, the reasons that they have brought us today, that some leaders of the world still say that we see the danger of the Third World War. This I don't want to hear as a human being. Why the Third World War? Why we see the signs of the Third World War? If you are really developed from any side and we want to be the leaders of the world, we must wither away. We must finish with the reasons very basically which exist and we can see. We must abolish them in order not to go to the path of the Third World War, not any war. The differences exist today. As I see from my point of view, there are some, if we say, there are terrorists, international terrorism, or Al-Qaeda, or so or so. Anyone, if we name them, how we cannot solve that? Can we solve the problems of the world only by political means? Or shall we think for negotiations and talks as well? Unless the human being can find the ways to reach to the very unreached places and they can explore in the sky or on the ground or underground something, they must explore the ways to go to make a compromise between those who are thinking only metaphysically to go to war and make suicidal attacks. Why we cannot reform them? Why we cannot change them? If you cannot change the minds and hearts of the world community and the human beings in the world, how can be we claiming that we can be the leaders of the world? So by that end, I want to thank those who organized this symposium, and maybe some drops we have learned more in our life here in this, in my opinion. And as a conclusion, I will say, any way, in any theory, in any path, if we want to take, if it is correct, it's okay, we must continue and develop it. If it is not correct, we must see the reasons. Withering away, abolishing the bad reasons will bring us to the nice and positive conclusions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Moving on to the session two, first, Professor Gilbert, please.
Well, as co-responsible for the so-called clash, co-responsible with Desmond, let me first say that I was rather surprised that this was considered a major event of the conference. I think it indicates differences in cultures. If you had this kind of a meeting in a Western academic or practitioner setting, this was a very small controversy indeed. Perhaps to bring it back to Japan, it was a storm in a teacup, as it were. As a matter of fact, you know, I like Desmond. I invited him to talk about precisely this issue when he comes to Cambodia. And to show solidarity with Professor Isasaki, I even took my tie off so that he does not feel marginalized. But to talk a little bit more seriously about this issue, I think this is an example of constructive conflict. As I said in my presentation today, conflict is necessary, I think. It's just what kind of conflict we're dealing with. Perhaps it's possible to see this in a terms of the dialectic, the notion of a thesis, antithesis, and then a synthesis at the higher level. Just very briefly, as you may recall from my presentation before the so-called clash, we are aware of the distinctions between academicians, theoreticians, and practitioners, and that's precisely the kind of issue that we want to deal with in this project I discussed, where we bring together academics, peace practitioners, field workers of various kinds, NGO people, and we will work. We'll be working on this, if not every day together, at least very consistently, so we can bridge that gap in some way and come up with solutions that make sense, both in terms of new ways of thinking about conflict and also ways in which conflicts can either be avoided or solved, and also so that together we may have some impact, hopefully, on some very important actors in this whole process of peace or conflict or violent conflict, namely the decision makers. So with that, I thank you, and I want to commend the organizers and all the other participants, panelists, discussants, audience, for what I think has been a very constructive couple of days, very active, and I think we will all go back and reflect on some of these things. Hopefully, we will get that synthesis out of it that will help all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Brenes, please.
I have four questions. I will read them first and then try to respond to them in an integral manner. And one says, if poor people and in some way forced to fight while rich people enjoy prosperity, what do you suggest we do to change that? How is democracy in modern society contribute to peace in conflict countries? I think these two are very related. As Mr. Ito mentioned, most of opinions are based on subjectivity, including the concept of Earth Charter as an academic option or opinion. How do you make people understand and agree with such a subjective concept? In particular, this is the fourth one, how do you make sure equality and equity of gender and any other marginalized peoples in peace education? I like your mention that we have to also take marginalized species into account, pura vida. That means pure life. That's a very common Costa Rican expression. We say it all the time. These are very wonderful questions. And first, I'd like to say that I was very much impressed by the last session and the commitment and the experience that the three presenters brought for us. And the critique I made previously, before that third session, I withdraw it now, because in the sense that I really do feel that as bridges, as communicators with the broader society, you do bring to us the awareness that there are many, many people out there in highly developed countries like Japan who have deep concern for the world, the peoples, and other places. In your presentation, Ms. Makita, I think you illustrated very well some of the concepts I was trying to convey before about the importance of these deep, positive communications that touch people's hearts, that really mobilize transformation, you know, the positive messages of deep solidarity, compassion, tolerance, and so on and so forth. And also that we have these powerful tools. I think that this false dichotomy that's been created today about the academy and practitioners is something we should not really take that seriously. I think it's a false dichotomy, quite frankly. And so I will relate this to the other questions about Earth Charter and the democratic society and gender. First of all, the Earth Charter, basically what it is, it's an ethical distillation of general principles, ethical principles that mostly in the 1990s, the last decade of the 20th century, were consensus that were achieved. Many of them through the large UN conferences and gatherings and conventions and declarations and so on. And so I think one of the very important things that we should bear in mind is that we do have a multilateral framework that's been created, and our governments have made commitments internationally in the name of nation states. Now, nation states includes the citizens of these nations. So these come down ultimately to rights and obligations, rights of citizens and obligations of states, and also duties of citizens and the general responsibility. And I think that Mr. Kawasaki reminded us about the importance of historical consciousness and how we have to practice democracy, even in so-called advanced democracies. We have to be very vigilant, and we have to now move ahead into a global democracy. So the Earth Charter, it cannot really, in and of itself, be effective. I mean, ethical movements in and of themselves do not exist. They are part of human action, integral action. As Professor Cushing was saying, we are political beings. Everything we do is a life politics. Every decision we make about how we live is a life. We're exercising our capacity to make choices. Now, the gender issue is tremendously important in this. I personally think that one of the main shifts in order to move into an integral peace concept is that the feminine experience has to be given a much more greater importance and appreciation. I make a distinction between feminine emancipation, which in some cases is becoming empowered in a patriarchal mode. That's not really a peaceful transformation. How can we, all of us, men, become, really practice the principles of caring, of love and compassion? That's why I emphasize so much. But we need to put this into practice through political action, democratic participation. So that's why we need these multilateral frameworks, and we need also to be very aware of our national constitutions. And I think a consciousness of democracy, coming from a Buddhist science of mind point of view, is basically a state of equanimity, defining equanimity as that mental capacity to see all beings, all sentient living beings, basically wanting not to suffer and wanting to be happy and not to discriminate. So a democracy seen from this point of view is a global democracy. And the great challenge in this time period we're in is to go beyond intra-group versus extra-group, whatever those identity groups might be, and to really see ourselves in as global equals, all humans, but ultimately all of the community of life. So I think that's the great vision, an opportunity for our time. I hope I touched all of them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. can we invite Professor Kilavera just very briefly, if possible, for a comment and suggestions?
This conference is very important in the sense that it will force us to think about the discipline of peace and conflict studies. Because peace and conflict studies is not a core discipline. It is a combined discipline. Therefore, still, it is a very young field. And in social science, we need new approaches, new theoretical vigor. Because, like urban studies, the gender studies, it is not a core discipline. Therefore, still, peace and security studies discipline has to rely on other classical social science disciplines. Therefore, we have to be very careful when we develop peace and security studies. It is very sad. When we think of peace and security, this is one of the fundamental requirements for human life from very beginning. Still, we have to raise very fundamental the questions, what is meant by security. Security is freedom from fear and threat. Then, what are the sources of security? What are the agents of threat? In order to understand these things, we don't have, theoretical categories of our own. Therefore, we have to borrow disciplines from the categories from other disciplines. That's why concept of state is very crucial and fundamental. Without referring to the state, we are very idealistic. We will not be able to do, grasp the reality of the problem. For example, when we take individual, we have to take collective individual. Individual, the concept can be understood in relation to his collective identity. Collective identity relates to its community. Community relates to the state. A state relates to the international system. Therefore, the crucial issue here is ultimately state formation and national integration. Therefore, when we think of the state, modern state is ethnic creature. In Asia, traditional state is state was not an ethnic creature. It is a civilizational state. It has different functions. But modern state was ethnic creature. Modern state emerged with killing hundreds of nations, collective identities. Take France. In order to create French state, they at least annihilated about 45 collective identities in Fronde Wars. Take Rose Wars, various things. Therefore, from colonial period, we got that ethnic state too, and it is superimposition of the ethnic state on civilizational states. Asian states were not ethnic states, maybe civilizational states, dynastic states. Still, this security problems, all these things should be understood in relation to this core fundamental issue. Therefore, even if we try to avoid issue of state without addressing the nature, role, and emerging systems of and institutions of power and governance, we will not be able to understand peace and security. This is very important.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are running time, so I wanted to ask all of the panelists from the third session for a comment, but I'm sorry, we don't have time, so just maybe one word per each person. Mr. Kasek, please.
Yes, one word. Well, I had some questions, so let me be brief about Article 9. One point was that to renounce war under Article 9 of Japan. the basic respect to the basic human rights, I think that what is of a preface of a Japanese constitution should be stressed more rather than starting to talk directly about Article 9.
I absolutely agree with that.
So peace without resorting on military, that is what Article 9 is saying. But a right to live in peace, that should be inset. Both must come together. So peace and democracy, human rights must all come together. Yesterday, we discussed about controlled paradigm to sustainable security. A paradigm shift is necessary. And I think it's related to that. So far, when we talk about peace or security, that was something to be controlled. The strong ones would control. It was closed. It would be closed more and more. That was security. But now security is should shift to something that is more open. And that is the theme linking all of us together. I also have received some questions. But let me try to refer to only one point, which is interesting. How to approach people who reject communication? This is a very simple question. The discussion about practitioners and academicians that we had before, looking at the current media, in particular in the developed nations, for instance, even if you try to make a peace communication in a country, the people in the country, including your friends, even within that sphere, to try to communicate what is taking place. Well, in case of an Iraq war, there was a lot of anti-war movement all over the world before the war was starting. I think it's the first time that there were so many anti-war movements, but still, war had started. We want peace, and that is why we are all here today. That's my purpose for being here. So we want peace. When you look at the TV's reporting about the war, that is something that you must think very well when you think about communication. A journalist has said that a media circus is taking place all over the world, in a colosseum, just like having a fight in a colosseum. Everyone knows that peace is good, but they want to look at images of war. They want to see battle. And the best explanation is to stop thinking. Though you are concerned about that, you say you have nothing to do with that, so the best way is to have a distance between you and what is taking place. That is the best way of reaching a solution within yourself. So how to treat people who reject communication? Including myself, best way is not to think about it. People who think you have nothing to do with that, with so many developments of the media, such people not interested will increase. So how to communicate the voices of the people who are affected by war? That becomes a more important and difficult. People who are looking at a media circus, if you are just watching, you are not a party to that. And if there are people, practitioners or people in academia watching the situation, you are just one person watching the circus show. Or you're just a spectator to the circus. So there must, as Maekita-san said, I think you must think of ways of triggering communication among such people. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I had raised a question of how to promote voluntary action. I think one thing is that people are weak and incomplete. That is weakness. The people who are sending information are weak. They are not strong. So the recipients of information think that they have to help them. You must make them feel the need of helping them. So the weak people should be made stronger, and the strong people must be made weaker. And if you do away with this concept, that may lead to peace among academia and practitioner. What is good about academia is that there's no taboo. You can say whatever you want. You don't have any clients who pay for you. And universities are supposed to be independent from the state, and the state could not join the academia. They were independent when the University of Hague was made. So there's no taboo in the academia. I envy that. And practitioners, us, one thing we can be proud about is that there are many people who don't like letters. So people who are here are strange people who like to read. We know that. So you're not interested in words and letters. That may be the difference between academicians and practitioners. So people who are strong should get weaker, and those who are weak should be treated stronger. I think that is the point.
Can we invite Professor Isozaki for a very brief concluding remark? Thank you.
I should be sexy. This is my concluding remarks. The question was, why is communication important? And this has been responded by Mr. Ito. I will not repeat. I do have my starting experience as an academia member. I wanted to offer political recommendations, and recently I went through a very important experience, that is the turmoil in our parliament, what to do about the Anti-Terrorist Act, which permits the self-defense is permitted to resupply in the Indian Ocean. I was asked by the opposition, Democratic Party of Japan, to offer my expert witness, thinking about the future of Afghanistan, or thinking about the war against terror in Afghanistan, how to conclude that war in Afghanistan. If we think what Japan can do, then I tried to think about some ways and offered my expert opinion to the opposition party of Japan. And as a result, the bill that was created was not in line with my idea. The opposition party who listened to me, the bill was much poorer than the leading party by the LDP. This is a classic case. As an academia, with my conscience, I had tried to do my best, but I was politically exploited by the political parties. I really went through that myself. And the countermeasure proposed by that opposition party was opposed even by the member parties, and therefore it was not even adopted by the Senate, even though our Senate at this moment is controlled by the opposition party. But because of that, because of this bitter experience, that doesn't deter myself from being involved in the political arena. We should not be silent. I must be more clever. So in comments of Session 2 and Session 3, there were good examples. Professor Obershell already has departed, but I'm not fair since he is absent. But he made a very provocative comment, that is, insurgents and with terrorists, in order to deal with them, for a temporary term, you can deviate from the Geneva Conventions or the normal rules. Now, should you deviate or not deviate just for emergencies and for temporary periods? The point is whether it is good or not. In reality, there are so many deviations. But as an academician, I think we have to point that out. It's a truth. But Professor Obershell probably, I hope, did not mean that we ought to deviate, because if you deviate from the Geneva Convention and other principles, many more people lose their lives. But the reality is, the fact is that there are lots of deviations. And if his intention was to expose that reality, if you make that kind of comment, the politicians will just carve that piece out and exploit it for their own interest. This happens to a lot of us academicians. You are utilized, exploited. So how will our wills and intentions be implemented in the ultimate phase? You have to be careful, you have to monitor and watch until the end, otherwise you will be misused. That is why the communication is important. When we think about peace area, and if you are a member of the academia, this is an important task. Don't be misused or abused.
Open up the to the floor for questions, but thank you for participating. And now I'd like to turn the microphone to the professor and vice rector of Tufts, Professor Miyazaki, for concluding remarks.